From the hills of central New York in the heart of the Finger Lakes, this is Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi. As we continue into our 11th season here at Frankly Speaking, I want to take a moment to shout out to our regular listeners. You're the reason we exist. To our sponsors who pay the bills and allow us to provide high production quality, and to the staff and community at turfnet.com. We are nowhere without our turfgrass community. My guest on this episode of Frankly Speaking is Dr. Manuel Chavarria, the turfgrass extension specialist at Texas A&M based in College Station at the Scotts Turfgrass Research Center. Dr. Chavarria received his PhD from Texas A&M and had brief stints at the University of Florida and the Prairie Turfgrass Research Center in Alberta, Canada. Dr. Chavarria has published his work on salinity tolerance of warm season grasses and is now pioneering turfgrass education programs for Spanish-speaking turfgrass professionals. Before we get to our conversation with Dr. Manuel Chavarria, let me remind you of the great value and commitment to service you get from our partners at The Plant Food Company. I'm entering my 23rd year of working with pros such as global sales lead Tom Weiner, who was the first to capture my attention with nutrient products that meet the needs of the modern superintendent with research to back it up. Check out the products and pros at The Plant Food Company at plantfoodco.com. Manuel, so great to have you here. Welcome to the show. I want to start by talking a little bit about your background, where you're from, and sort of how you got to be interested in turf based on where you were from.
Yeah, well, I have dual citizenship. From my mother's side is from Spain, and from my father's side is from Mexico.
Okay.
I grew up in Mexico, and I got my bachelor's, master's degree in Mexico. My bachelor's was in natural resources. And my master degree was in forest science, like a forestry.
Right.
It was kind of a hybrid. I was working in forestry, but at the same time in rangelands. Because in Mexico, there are a lot of people having ranches. They have cows, mm-hmm. but at the same time, they have forest. Mm-hmm. So they put all the cows, all the animals in the forest, you know. They need to eat all the grass.
That's right.
So yeah. I need to study both ecosystems.
Yeah, so this is very common in many countries, and especially where it's warmer, the silver pasturing.
Yes.
The agroforestry, where you're using the forest for multiple agricultural purposes. You know, we do it with maple syrup and mushrooms and wood and shade-tolerant understory plants like pawpaws and things like that. We have a pretty interesting agroforestry demonstration and a couple of classes here at Cornell. So that's what your original work was in, was the diversified landscapes where forests were involved and animals grazing on grass?
Exactly. The another point is I evaluate prescribed burn.
Mm.
So Mexico, the farmers, they burn the grass. In that way, they can recover the good quality in order to feed the animals.
Yeah.
So this practice also is very common in Florida. So in Florida, they burn all the biomass.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, they control the fire. In that way, they have like a positive benefit for the ecosystem.
Right.
Because in Mexico, in the environment that I was working, the forest is Pinus hartigui. The Pinus hartigui, they need the fire in order to release the seed from the cone.
Okay. So it's a pine. What is the common name of that pine?
I don't remember. I just remember the scientific name, Pinus hartigui. So it's in Mexico City. It's the most predominant species.
So they're burning the vegetation in the forest without burning the trees.
Exactly.
It's very interesting.
It's under control situations. There are experts at doing that, working with the city, with the farm. So they control, I mean, they know how to burn the environment.
Mm-hmm.
They need to check the wind, humidity, mm-hmm. all the environmental conditions. In that way, the fire doesn't get out of control, you know, and you can have a serious problem.
Okay. So you finish college. You have an internship studying these forestry systems.
Yes.
How does that get itself into turf?
Well, because Mexican Spanish mix, we love soccer.
Football everywhere else except America.
Exactly. Football is like a religion in my family. Yeah. My grandfather loves the Real Madrid.
Okay.
My grandfather was from La Coruña in the north of Spain, in the coast. So that is what's super popular. This is in the way like I grew up, just watching every single weekend Real Madrid. So I love the nature. When I was in my high school, you know, it's the most important decision. What are you going to study, you know? But at the same time, it's in the worst part of your life because you don't know what you need to do.
True. And you have to pick a trade to study, right? Which could be greenkeeping or the study of it, right?
Yeah. So I love the nature. I love all the time be outside. I love to camping. But at the same time, I need to work in the office. So I was looking for something between. Like, for that reason, I didn't know what to study, honestly. Yes, I pick up natural resources because for me, it's kind of like a general topic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that you can study agronomy, horticulture, forestry, rangeland. So it's a little bit of favorite. But at the end, finishing my bachelor's and when I finish my master's degree, I start to see, like, for example, Mexico has a lot of golf courses. And I said, hey, I would like to work in that environment. I would like to work in that business. And I realized, like, Mexico doesn't have that profession. Doesn't exist turf grass management. Yours is agronomy in general. Agronomy, ecology, biology, but nothing about turf grass. So I started to do research, and I found out, like, just in the United States, you can get this degree. I know, like, there are some countries in Spain, in Canada, but not like the United States. United States is, like, the big and number one country in turf grass management. So when I start to do research and I say, hey, I want to get my PhD in turf grass, so what is the difference? So, like, I know about cows, I know about grass. So the cows mow the grass.
Yeah.
So here in this environment, it's just the mower, it's the machine, you know, it's an equipment. But in general, it's almost the same plant. You know, obviously it's not the same, but right. Yes, I was thinking they need photosynthesis, they need water. So the management is different, but I have the main knowledge already.
That's right. Okay, so now you finish up, you decide in somewhere between 2011 and 12 to go to graduate school and you decide Texas A&M.
Yeah, I finished my master's degree in December 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with one professor, with my main advisor, doing like a research, you know, general research, helping, and just sending letters to every single university, you know, like, hey, I wanted to just send in my resume, introducing myself. I was lucky to come to Texas A&M.
So you get to A&M, and now you got to figure out what to study. So you're working with Ben, I'm assuming, Ben Worley?
Yes, Benjamin Worley was my main advisor, and Ambika Chandra, Dr. Russell Jessop, and Raul Cabrera.
Okay, so you get there, and you decide to study salinity.
Well, I didn't decide, honestly. Well, Benjamin Worley have already the project, the SRI project.
Perfect.
So I was curious about salinity too, because in Mexico also we have salinity problems. So yes, I was kind of like picking or choosing a topic, a problem to resolve, and just was like a coincidence. Like, I have that curiosity, and Dr. Benjamin Worley already has the project.
Okay, so we'll skip over some of the salinity work, and we'll come back to it. But I want to talk about the rest of your career, which then wound up bringing you back to A&M. And I think that's where, when we bumped into each other, I'm like, wait, I thought you were A&M, and then I lost track of you for a little bit, and now you're back at A&M. So you had the pleasure of both spending some time in Alberta, Canada, and then for a very short period of time at the University of Florida. But I want to talk about your very interesting time at the Prairie Turfgrass Research Center. And for those listening, this is a place that's had a long history of turfgrass research. Daryl Tompkins was there. Jim Ross was there for a really long period of time. And they did some of the really exceptional work on annual bluegrass winter hardiness up there. So you walked into a historically good place, but I also knew that since Jim had moved on, things were not going so well there. So obviously, first off, it was cold, yes?
Yes. Was my first time that I saw the snow. I mean, I finished my PhD in 2017, and then I was looking for jobs. Dr. Casey Reynolds at that time, he was the assistant professor in extension in A&M.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me the opportunity to work like a postdoc, know, I was doing like a project with him. But it was in a super, super small period of time because he moved to TPI and then Benjamin Wehrlich took the responsibility of that project with Dr. Kevin Martinez. Mm-hmm. In that project is when I started to work in pigments and also in some like a particle size distributions, evaluating different right. greens here in Texas.
Yes. Okay. So then you're off to Canada.
Yeah, I worked for 1 year and I found a job in Canada, in Alberta, in BTRC, like a Prairie Native Grass Research Center in Olds. I realized like Olds is the highest point in all the continent to do research in cool season grasses. So the geography is amazing.
Yeah.
The winter is long. You can have 6 months of snow.
Yes.
The winter is not so bad because it's not as intense as in Toronto. Like you can have a lot of snow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the winter in Alberta is longer.
Yeah.
It's not terrible. I start to learn how to survive.
You have to keep yourself busy.
Yeah, and once in a while you have like a super, super low temperatures. But it's just not terrible. It's maybe 1 week, 2 weeks, like you can be at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay. So let's go back to the Olds discussion. You get there in 2018, you've adapted to the cold weather. How long did you know that maybe it wasn't going to be staying open?
So, I mean, I was hired by Katie Dodson. After 1 month, Katie moved to Switzerland because she took a job in Syngenta.
Ah.
So I started to work, learning a lot, try to understand the cool environment, cool season grasses, but was in a very short time because I started in September, but by September 15, we have snow.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. I mean, just I start to read, check, some winter projects start to come, you know, yeah. Like particularly with all the chemical companies, Syngenta, BASF, Adama,
yeah.
Try to evaluate like a snow mold in British Columbia.
So when did you find out it was going to be closing?
The COVID was a mess because in Canada, I was paying my own salary with the projects that I have. At the beginning, was fine. Nobody knows for how long that situation will be. So at the beginning, just was 1 month and then 2 months. And it started to be longer and longer and longer. The Olds College laid off around, I don't know, 70 people in the first 6 months of the COVID.
Oh, boy.
After that, I have a meeting with my boss. And my boss says, hey, Manuel, will be like a bad situation for you in the future. So you have a budget for 6 months. And that is your budget. Or you bring more projects, or you start to look for another job.
Okay. So it was clear for a while, you were pretty self-sufficient there. The economics around COVID caused the college to respond in a particular way.
Yeah.
So now, you know, you're finishing up maybe in early 21. It looks like you immediately got the opportunity to go to Florida.
Well, no, in Canada, Casey Reynolds invited me to collaborate to develop this kind of like a manual or handbook, the Weed Insect and Disease publication. If you check that publication, I am a part of the authors. So when TPI published that publication or that book,
yes,
Casey Reynolds invited me to go to the TPI conference in Orlando.
Ah.
So at that time, I went. My focus was to look for a job.
Okay.
This is my current situation. I have the amazing opportunity to talk with Dr. Kevin Kenworthy.
Okay. So he had an opportunity for you to come down, at least work in his research team.
Yes. I talked with him. He says, Manuel, I have a postdoc position. I mean, you are in Canada, you are the boss, but I have a postdoc position. Mm-hmm. You realize about that? I say, yes, I don't care. I need to put food on my table.
Yeah.
I don't care about the positions. I don't care about the titles right now. I care about I need to eat. I need to pay the bills.
It's very good. Okay, so listen, we're going to wrap up this segment, and I just have you tell me how surprised you were or excited you were to see the opportunity open up at Texas A&M, where this journey in America at least began for you.
Yeah, I was excited because I got my PhD in A&M. I know the environment. I know all the faculty. So I was like coming home again.
That's right. So how does it feel to be a colleague to the people that were mentors to you in your graduate school process? How does that feel?
Weird.
Very good. And I can tell you, from somebody who did that, I came back to Cornell 6 years after I finished my PhD here. And I can tell you, it is an awkward transition to make from being a graduate student who looks to the faculty as mentors to being a colleague. And so I really appreciate your simple and candid answer about this. I'm Frank Grassi. I'm with Manuel Chavarria. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back. Nothing works on your putting surfaces if your soils don't function properly. They have to drain well, resist compaction, and maintain acceptable amounts of organic matter. Invariably, soils will get layered, compaction will influence turf performance, and drainage will slow. Dryject Services have the tools to address all of these physical property issues in one pass. Learn more about Dryject Services at dryject.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Manuel Chavarria. Manuel, it's so great to learn about your background. And like everybody in this business, it takes a very interesting path to lead us to, you know, in our case, you and I studying the same sorts of things. But to get here, you went through a degree program and have published some work in the scientific literature around salinity tolerance of the warm season grasses and looking at the cultivars. And of course, you know, this is a thing that not only requires understanding of the way grasses manage high sodium concentrations when they're exposed in the soil solution, but also the way plants have to respond to the impact of sodium on soil structure. So I'm wondering, you used to work in ag, and we talk a lot about soil health in ag. I know you were just talking about how forestry managers that are managing grazing areas are burning the vegetation. Did you have some soil knowledge that you gained in your days doing ag that sort of helped a little bit on the soils part of the salinity work that you had to do?
No, I mean, my study was completely looking at the plant response under the salinity stress. I didn't check too much about the soil reaction.
Okay. So then with regard to the grasses, Ben had a project to do this. Was it through the sod growers or was it through a USDA grant? Tell me how the nature of the project you were working on came about.
If I remember very well, I guess, it was part of the SRI project that Dr. Ambika Chandra got in 2012, 2013.
Okay.
So was funded by USDA.
And particularly looking at drought stress and salinity stress, I would imagine.
Yes.
Okay. So when you were screening these cultivars, it looks like an enormous amount of work. Can you take a minute and describe the nature of the work that you did looking at plant responses?
Oh, yeah. I remember my days in the greenhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, we developed like a hydroponic system in the greenhouse to evaluate four different salinity levels, like the control, but actually on the water and fertilizer solution, we have like a 2.5 decisims.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to 15, 30, and 45 decisims.
That's right.
So it's 45 decisims is close to like the ocean level.
Right. That's right.
Salinity stress. Mm-hmm. The ocean has 55. Mm-hmm. So I evaluate close to 90 different entries.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
We have four replications. So in total, I have close to 900 pots in the greenhouse.
Okay.
It was
a lot of work. And I've been enjoying reading it in preparation for this. And one of the things I always think about, because we do, you know, over the years, cool season grasses, because they're developed by seed, we saw an enormous proliferation of cultivars, 170 bluegrass. Grasses, 115 tall fescue, some ridiculous number that used to be in the NTEP things. And one of the things that used to come up was very interesting is that sometimes the cultivars, the variability in of species, right, like bluegrass had 170 some odd cultivars. The variability between the cultivars is even bigger than the variability between the species. Like they're so different within each one. Let's just start talking about the species levels. Did you find they broke out as expected as species before you got into cultivars? Like when you looked at the Bermuda grasses and the Paspalums, were they always better than the Zoysia grasses and the St. Augustines?
Some of them, yes. Caesar Paspalum always was the top number one, you know, salinity tolerant grass. Some cultivars from Bermuda grasses of the same, like if I remember, was, I guess, Celebration.
Yeah.
Competing close to the Caesar Paspalum cultivars. And then kind of like in the middle, something not too high, Soysia grasses, and the worst is an Augustine grass.
Mm. Oh, so the worst is St. Augustine grass for the salt tolerance that you found.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So one of your papers, the one that you put in ASHS, where you looked at tolerance and recovery, right? I thought that was very interesting to look at how the plants recovered from the 15, 30, and 45 decicentimeter levels, right? Can you talk a little bit about why you looked at recovery? What was it? I mean, it's like when these plants are under salinity stress, they're under salinity stress. Are you maybe thinking recovery is how it would be if you could leach? Was that the nature of looking at recovery after you took away the salt stress?
Yeah, I mean, we tried to flush every single weekend the salts that were accumulated on the top to see which species were able to recover after 4 weeks.
Right. So were these fairway height plots in general, or were they lawn height plots?
It was a little bit of everything. Okay. It was more like a fairway and lawns.
Mm-hmm.
Something that we have in mind, Dr. Weber and myself, is to evaluate pulling green species of cultivars.
Okay.
Because there is no research about pulling greens. There are a lot of research about salinity stress and different grasses, but not about pulling greens in a specific.
I'm very curious about some of this data, and, you know, I think it was a really interesting and really well done piece of work. So big kudos to all you guys for doing this. It's not something I think about a lot because we don't generally have these kinds of problems in most of the areas where I practice my trade. And so when I look at this, I'm wondering a couple of things. I sort of look at the 15 level or maybe the 30 level as a very interesting number because it's like quality's off of almost all the varieties that you tested. Yeah. Growth is down, but they don't die completely. And so, you know, when I think about this, if there's no traffic on that grass, Manuel, and you can pigment them if you want to turn them colors, and we'll get to that in a second, but it isn't the worst thing if they're not growing very much. And if they don't get much traffic, would you say that almost all of these grasses could tolerate long periods of salinity stress before dying? Or did some of the 30 decicentimeter treatments ultimately lead to death? Because I'm thinking about salinity as a growth regulator, you know, as a way to minimize mowing on maybe golf courses or lawns. And if you can just get it to look halfway decent, no one's going to care.
Yeah, I mean, salinity is a cycle. When I say it's a cycle, it's like it's not permanent. What I want to say is this. For example, in Texas, during the rainy season, like it's usually the spring, sometimes fall, during the rainy season, all the salts are pushing down. So actually, you don't have too much salinity problems, not too many salinity problems during the spring and fall. The salinity problems comes when the rainfall goes away, like it's the drought season. In Texas, you can have 90, almost 100 days with no rainfall. So high temperatures, and is when you have high evapotranspiration and the salinity problems start. So under these circumstances, obviously, for my experiment, all these grasses are going to die if you keep that concentration.
That's right. Okay.
But just because it's a cycle, you have these ups and downs, so you have this period of time like the plants are going to recover.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. And we, you know, we don't think about that very much, that there is a cycle to it, that if the plants can tolerate it for a period of time, they can persist in those areas. And that's why I've also sort of been interested, because a lot of these sodium levels, if they're not on, you know, sand-based systems, can be problematic for the soils. But I mentioned some other work that you spent some time on, and I just want to chat with you a little bit about your work with pigments and just focus on what people managing turf ought to know about dyes, pigments, paints, these what you guys call colorants, I guess, would be the way you'd classify them. What should every superintendent sort of know about the dyes, pigments, and paints?
I don't know. I mean, it all depends if they like it or not to use this type of pigments. You know, if I run into some superintendents like they don't like to apply these because maybe it's negative for them.
Mm-hmm.
But another ones, no, maybe, I mean, when we went to Arizona the last 2 weeks, I saw like some golf courses. It looks like they paint the greens.
Yeah.
I didn't walk through the golf course, just from outside. It seems like a little bit fake.
Yeah. Well, some of the overseeding, the non-overseeding guys are painting down in the Phoenix Valley. But I would say there's still a significant number, if not the majority, are still overseeding greens with a little bit of Poa trivialis. But in general, when I think about the use of these colorants where you are in Texas, I think about using them to extending the growing season. I mean, one of the things we know about these pigments in the shoulders of the season is that they draw heat to the canopy, right? And of course, warm season grasses are, you know, want an even more amount of heat than cool season grasses. But with the warm season grasses, have you played around at all with extending growth where otherwise without it, they might go dormant?
I didn't do that like that study, no. So just the main focus was to study all these different pigments to see what is the wavelengths or radiation, like which one are reflected and which one was absorbed. And also one of the next focus of this research is to see the chemical elements, which ones are toxic, which ones not.
Ah, okay.
It's something like we want to study in the future, like the chemistry of these pigments to see which elements can be toxic and under which concentration, you know.
And you're going to keep doing this work in your new role?
Yeah, part of my goals is continue studying or doing research in salinity stress, dry stress.
Good.
It's like a plant stress physiology in general.
Yeah. Well, I'm with Dr. Manuel Chavarria from Texas A&M. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back. I started working with Ken Rost and the professionals at Frost Spray Technologies in 2018 with some GPS-guided spray technology, and now we're integrating the Frost application system with the Greenkeeper app, and I gotta tell you, it's a no-brainer. Get control of your GPS sprayer with Frost Spray Technologies and get the most out of it with your Greenkeeper app. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi. I'm with Dr. Manuel Chavarria at Texas A&M University. And obviously, your first language is Spanish, I'm assuming, and your second language is English. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, sir.
So you have to hear something in English. Your brain processes it enormously quickly in Spanish, and then you're able to then translate what you want to say from Spanish back into English. This is something you had to work on over the years, right, Manuel? Were you doing this in Mexico, or did you start to get more bilingual as you came to the States?
Yeah, I studied English in Mexico, and the first year and a half or 2 years in the United States was super stressful for me, because you think like you know English in your country. But one thing is to study English. Another thing is to live the language. It's different. Mm-hmm. Living the language is like a swimming, you know? You have to swim the language. You have to listen different accents, mm-hmm. different countries also mm-hmm. speaking the same language. Something that you don't learn at the school.
Yeah. And it's so great to hear you say that out loud, that it's scary and stressful. And those things alone keep many non-English speaking people, regardless of the language, from making the jump into English. It's not an easy language to learn. And as you said, when you're trying to live in the country where the language is spoken, it's very different than how you pick it up learning it in school, wherever you come from. So really appreciate you saying that. And so I'm wondering, what I've really admired about your extension work so far has been your real assertiveness in bringing turf grass education to the Spanish-speaking workforce and leaders that are in our industry that you're working with, you know, right now, primarily in Texas. How did that come about, and what kind of feedback are you getting from the students that are in there?
Well, everything started since when I was getting my PhD, having the opportunity to travel in the United States for ASA conference or the GCSA conference. When I was doing like this poster competition or the oral competition, you see who is another student, I don't know, in different universities. You know your audience, you know different students from different universities. And I realized like I was the unique Hispanic in the turf grass program.
You are.
So I was the first Hispanic in Texas A&M, a PhD level in turfgrass program. You can see multiple or different Hispanic in tomatoes, in corn, in cotton, but yes, I'm talking about turfgrass. I was the first Hispanic in A&M. In the conference, I was looking for a different Hispanic, and I was not able. I mean, I didn't identify somebody. So when we have all this conference, I was thinking, okay, the superintendents are able to come, but the workers, they don't come. So when I applied for this position, I did my research and I realized Texas has almost 49% of the population, close to 50% of the population are Hispanic. Doesn't mean like they are not bilingual. Mm-hmm. No? They are bilingual, but this is my justification.
Right.
So if you go to China and you know Chinese, but there is like a class in English, like your mother language.
Yes.
You're going to pick up your mother language.
That's right.
No?
Of course.
Even like you know Chinese, if you have that option, you're going to pick up your mother language.
That's right.
So for that reason, when I applied for this position, I saw myself like, you know what? I am the unique Hispanic in the United States in turfgrass program that can teach from Florida to California in Spanish. So you already have English speaker professors.
Yeah.
You are covering only 50% of the population, but the another 50%, nobody is taking care about that.
That's right.
So I offer myself to teach in all the spectrum, in English and Spanish. When I was in Florida, I met Marco Schiavone.
Yep.
He's Italian, but his wife is from Argentina. And we became a good friends. And I realized like he speaks Spanish. So I talked to him, hey, we can teach in Spanish. I started to give Spanish classes or presentations at the UCSA, I don't know, since 2016, something like that. Dr. Warley discussed that situation with me. Hey, Manuel, you can take advantage of that situation. So I was teaching, and with Marco, we developed a seminar in 2021 in Spanish. And every single year, I have been teaching. And now I try to develop this program in short courses in English, but also at the same time in Spanish.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So feedback from the students. Who are they? Are they the actual working staff, the guys that are mowing and line trimming and raking bunkers? That's who's coming?
Yes.
What are they saying to you? What are they telling you at the end of these things?
They like it. Even like the managers or superintendents, they like the idea to provide this type of training for the Spanish-speaking workers. I see this like a snowball. Mm-hmm. Right now it's super small, but I think like in the future it's going to grow. And hopefully we can have a good audience. So right now, different entities here in Texas, they are checking me and now they are inviting me to provide classes in Spanish.
Okay. So one of the things I want to talk to you about before I let you go is you can learn the language, but there are cultural things that exist that are very different. Just because everybody speaks Spanish doesn't mean, I mean, they're not all from Mexico. They're not all from South America. They might be from other places. I think one of the first things I want you to clarify for people is, you know, we use the word Latino, Latinx, whatever sort of way you want to say it. It is important to recognize that we use that word as Americans, but it represents a wide range of different cultures that happen to speak similar types of Spanish. Is that correct?
Yeah, there is a big bad conception about this terminology.
Mm.
Do you know the difference between Hispanic and Latino?
I don't.
People confuse that. People think that is the same thing, but it's not the same.
Mm.
Latin is a mother language. You can speak French and you are Latin.
Yeah.
If you are Italian, you are Latin. If you speak Spanish, you are Latin.
Mm.
So there are more than five languages. That means like you are Latin. So
okay.
people from France, white, blue eyes, speaking French, they are Latin people.
Okay. All right, good. This is good clarification for me. Excellent.
Hispanic means countries that they were conquered by Spain. So for example, Brazil, they are Latin, but they are not Hispanic.
That's right. Brazil, they speak Portuguese.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So what is the preferred way of referring to the people in your audiences? Spanish speaking?
Yeah, yes, I put like courses in Spanish.
Courses in Spanish.
Yeah, yeah, like a turfgrass management course in Spanish.
In Spanish. And that's it. And it's generally for people who English is a second language.
Yes.
Okay, so that's good. Thank you for that clarification. Let me ask a couple of more questions. Has there been any pushback in doing this? Because you often hear, well, people come, they should learn the language. Why should we do this in this language? You know, you answered it early on that it's scary and hard and you need time. And I think it limits access. So I'm wondering, have you heard anything about or feel like, you know, it's not good to be teaching in Spanish? We should be encouraging Spanish speakers to learn in English.
No, like, not in that way, but sometimes kind of like the energy, you know, like sometimes people, they don't care, like they don't give the value of that situation. Hmm. I mean, no, in a specific, like, no, I don't like it, or why we have to do that? No, but sometimes it's challenging. It's challenging for me to get audience in this way, because the Spanish workers, or the Latinos, they are the workers. They don't have the power to decide which conference they can go. Mm-hmm. So they need to request permission or authorization to the manager or mm-hmm. superintendent. Mm-hmm. If you have a landscape company, for example, you are the manager, you can go to any conference, but the company still is working. But in the opposite way, like you have to take two or three, I don't know, five guys if you want. You are taking employees from their real job.
Yeah, their jobs. Yeah, their jobs are not going to get done. When the superintendent leaves, if everybody's doing the work, the superintendent can be away. That's the difference between management and labor. In many ways, they're doing the actual labor.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You're saying this can be tricky sometimes for the Spanish-speaking workforce to be able to get to the conferences, but it must be that their superintendents are encouraging this and promoting this to their workforce.
Exactly. It all depends about the manager, the superintendent, if they are willing to sponsor some of the workers to attend this type of events. So it all depends about the manager. Mm.
Have you found many managers in Texas? It looks like the classes have many students in them when I see the pictures. Have you found at least a collection of superintendents or turfgrass managers that are happy to send their workers to these things?
Yeah, I mean, I have different type of events. I have events like I only have two persons in the room. Mm. And the last event that I went to Houston, I have 120 people.
Okay.
Again, it all depends about the manager. If the manager see the value of that, they are going to send the people to the conference.
So what would you say to every manager about the value of what you're doing to their operation?
I don't know. Obviously, they can get the value. They can get all the workers. They have a lot of knowledge and experience, you know, the real experience. Something that these type of workers, they don't know is why they are doing this, why you have to irrigate, why you have to fertilize, when. So they are good. They have a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience, but they don't know the whys. Mm. And for me, it's important to teach them in that way they can perform a better job. The industry can maybe be more successful and they can get more money at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a win-to-win for everybody. Yeah. But again, they need to see the value. And obviously, I don't want to touch this, but I need to say it. There are several problems, political problems between the United States and Mexico about all this type of immigration. Mm-hmm. For example, in my case, just because I speak Spanish, immediately they think that I am illegal. Mm-hmm. This type of stereotypes, like, it's something that I'm facing every day, you know? Mm.
It's very interesting because I'm also thinking that among the many people working in the workforce that are Spanish speaking, there are those that have come in without being processed and maybe exactly the way we'd like them to be processed. And there's a lot of fear associated with that as well. The fear, you know, they're not going to show up at anything because of the potential fear of being sent back. And I'm with you. I mean, you don't have to say it. I'll say it. We've got a lot of issues as a country with immigration. And I would say,
yes.
Two things I would say. One is it needs to be monetized in a way that it can function effectively, which it clearly isn't right now from a legal immigration perspective. I mean, I think that's what we're talking about. And then there's the 8 million jobs that are sitting around going undone because we're not processing legal immigration, which has built this country. And people could stop listening to me forever about this. I don't care. But my family came on a boat here just a couple of generations ago, and we were afforded an opportunity. And now I worry that we're not affording that opportunity to the next generation. And I'm really hopeful that programs like what you're doing with your Spanish-speaking classes begins to foster real desire for learning and advancement and grab that piece of what we still call this dream here in this country that people can realize, right? I mean, that's why people are coming here. So I got to believe you feel pretty good about providing access to Spanish-speaking people who might not otherwise have it.
Yeah, I mean, my main focus is just to contribute to the society, no matter who you are, what language you speak is, or what color you have in your skin. So my main focus is to provide to the society, to the Texas society, to the American society, in the turfgrass industry, to improve the industry in general. Doesn't matter what is your nationality.
That's right. Manuel, it has been such a joy chatting with you. I'm so glad we bumped into each other out in Phoenix, and it looked like you were busy and having a good time. I'm glad your career down there in Texas is off to a really good start. I want to thank you for taking the time and wish you the best in the next bunch of years, and I'll look forward to bumping into you again.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for this invitation, and hopefully we can run into again in different conferences.
Yes.
In the future.
All right, Dr. Manuel Chavarria, I'm Frank Rossi. This has been Frankly Speaking. Thank you for joining us. Big thanks to Dr. Manuel Chavarria. Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet family of podcasts, is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Frankly Speaking is in its 11th season, and we thank our major sponsors, Frostbray Technologies, Dryject Services, and the Plant Food Company, for the support that makes us possible. Take a minute and explore what they have to offer. Frankly Speaking is produced at Rep Studios in downtown Ithaca, New York, by Nate Richardson, with artwork and music by Nicole and Tucker Rossi, support from Peter McCormick, John Kiger, and John Reitman. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining me.